University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or this station. Today, University Forum presents Robert Poole, president of the Reason Foundation of Santa Barbara, California, one of the nation's leading free market-oriented think tanks. His topic is privatization, national garage sale, or golden opportunity. His expertise in the role of government in society was gained through 9 years of consulting with local governments in 7 states.
Good morning and welcome to Forum. Today's speaker is president of Reason Foundation, one of the country's leading free market-oriented think tanks. He is publisher of Reason Magazine. He has written and edited several books. Many of his articles on public policy have appeared in periodicals such as the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Futurist, and the Freeman. He is a regular commentator on the daily radio program, Perspective on the Economy. His consultation has been sought by the White House. A great deal of our speaker's work has been focused on the issue of privatization. And that is what the subject which he's going to address today at Forum and later in Callan Conference Center. Ladies and gentlemen, let me present Dr. Robert Poole.
Thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here today in Nebraska. Privatization has become practically a national buzzword the last couple of years. It's important to try to get a handle on what it is and what it isn't. The context in which I'd like to talk about it today is the federal government and the subject of what the federal government does is one that we all ought to be concerned about. For the last several years, and apparently for the next several years into the future, federal government will be taking in taxes about $200 billion a year less than it spends. And that means that the national debt increases by that amount each year. That in turn means that interest has to be paid on that debt. That interest is now running at something like between $120 and $140 billion a year. That's an expense that will go on and on into the future, that all of us will have to pay and our children will have to pay, and that most of that money is financing current consumption rather than real investments in the future. Partly because of the evident absurdity of that sort of thing, I think it's fair to say, and surveys do show this, that most Americans and even most members of Congress, if you ask them, is government spending too much, will say yes. And they'll say, in response to poll takers, that we should solve this problem of the deficit by cutting spending rather than by raising taxes. Fortunately, everybody says this, but spending doesn't get cut. The question that we need to look at is why? Why doesn't it get cut? Well, every single thing that the government does has a constituency that's in favor of doing it. The constituency includes those who provide whatever the service are, whether those are bureaucrats or contractors like defense contractors, includes those who directly are beneficiaries, those who benefit from that particular government program. Those people have a very direct, tangible incentive in lobbying and working hard, spending time and money to maintain that program in existence, whereas the average taxpayer has only a very small incentive in cutting out that particular program. That program may only amount to 50 cents or a dollar a year in the taxpayer's tax bill. So the cost to the taxpayer is very small. The benefits to the beneficiaries are very large. So obviously, who spends the money to keep the program going and who is apathetic about it? And you can see, therefore, why there's a built-in bias in favor of continuing spending, continuing programs, even those that most people would agree don't work very well. In addition, though, there's what I conceive of as a marketing problem involved. When you have ongoing political struggles over government spending, it's very easy for the advocates of a government program to be portrayed as the providers of benefits, and for the advocates of cuts in those programs or elimination of programs to be portrayed as the takers away of benefits. So you can easily get media battles and news coverage portraying the battle over federal spending as a good guys, bad guys struggle, in which the good guys are those who favor government programs, giving things. The bad guys are those who favor what you might call fiscal responsibility, taking away of government programs. And as long as the issue is framed in those terms, it's again easy to see why the advocates of spending are likely to win out. Now, a basic principle in marketing is that you can't replace something with nothing. The advocates of government programs have a very tangible something to sell. People who just say we should eliminate those government programs are in effect offering to replace the tangible something with nothing. And again, I don't think there's going to be any change in the spending until we see the issue in different terms than that. My contention this morning is that privatization offers a new way of looking at the issues, an entirely different way of framing the debate over government spending and the size and nature of government. It offers a different something to replace the government programs. In fact, it basically, my contention is that privatization shows people how many goods and services that they now look to for government can be provided better, and in many cases at less cost, in the private sector. And that's what I hope to at least demonstrate to you or suggest the argument for that today. Now, as preliminary to this, I think we need to look at why is government doing all the things that it's doing? If you've taken economics or an introductory political science course, you've probably heard the concept of public goods versus private goods. In other words, there's a theoretical construct that says that certain types of goods and services are different from the kind of private goods and services that the marketplace can provide. National defense is probably the classic example of a so-called public good. If someone produces national defense services, in other words, maintains an army and an air force and a navy, then the territory is protected, and everyone within that territory, the United States, Belgium, whatever it might be, receives the benefits from that service, whether or not they can somehow be charged for it directly. In fact, it's very difficult to exclude people who would not voluntarily pay for defense services. So most political science and scientists and economists would say defense is a different kind of a thing. It's a public good rather than a private good, and therefore needs to be provided by government and paid for by taxes. Well, if you look at most of the things that that governments today, local, state, and federal governments, actually do, other than defense and income redistribution programs, most of them are not really public goods. Most of them are commercial-type services that can be produced by private enterprise and that can be charged for directly by the users in proportion to the extent that they use them. So once you understand this, you can see that there's at least the potential of moving many of these goods and services from the public sector into the private sector. Now, the question is it really just equivalent to have them in the public sector or the private sector? I will argue no. In fact, that when goods and services are produced in the public sector, there are a great many extra costs and disadvantages. The production decisions about what gets produced and who gets them are thoroughly politicized by interest group battles, and we see all sorts of bizarre consequences. Now, rather than leaving that as simply a theoretical statement, let me read to you from a clipping from the Wall Street Journal, a front-page story about, in April of 84, about the New York subway system, a classic example of a public enterprise. This story tells about the travails of the new head of the New York subway system in his first few weeks on the job. I'll just quote a few little excerpts. New York subway riders have become accustomed to delays, breakdowns, graffiti, filth, and crime. But there are countless problems they often don't see. At the Hoyt Street subway station in Brooklyn, for instance, some of the ties are so rotten that the railroad spikes can be plucked out by hand. Going down a little further, mismanagement within the Transit Authority is almost comical. Workers at the Coney Island repair shop recently had to bring their own rags and sponges because the TA was out of them. On the other hand, the agency had a 27-year supply of radiator assemblies and a 144-year supply of snow chains for buses, according to the MTA Inspector General. Another excerpt a little further down. When several TA vice presidents visited a bus garage in Upper Manhattan recently, They found a unionized foreman letting a mechanic work on his own car, even though nearby buses with broken doors and smashed windows needed repair. The vice presidents decided it would be futile to discipline the foreman because of job protection provided by the transit unions. Now, if this is the best we can do with the public enterprises, ladies and gentlemen, we're in serious trouble. But in fact, now this may be a somewhat extreme example, but all too often this is the kind of perverse results that we get when an enterprise is taken from the private sector and put into the public sector. It starts serving all sorts of different purposes, such as protecting cushy jobs, rather than truly serving the needs of consumers. In fact, transit economists now recognize that, or at least many of them do, that the massive takeovers of public transit, of municipal transit, by local governments in the United States was probably a serious mistake. And the World Bank and other agencies are pointing to the success of decentralized, low-cost, largely private transit in places like Hong Kong, Singapore, Manila, Buenos Aires, Caracas, and many other major cities overseas, and saying that that is a much better model that we could be following in the United States than the centralized government taken over transit that we actually operate. What's true for transit has been shown extensively at the local government level all across the United States over the last 10 years. We've been studying this phenomenon of state and local privatization for practically a decade now at Reason Foundation, my organization. We have a very impressive empirical record from study after study that shows that when we can replace a municipal monopoly with some form of competition, when we can replace taxation with market pricing as a way of funding a service, when we can, in other words, put in a profit incentive rather than a bureaucratic incentive, what we tend to get over and over and over again in these real-world examples is lower costs, innovations, and better service. And there are half a dozen books now documenting the success of privatization at the state and local level, showing with specific examples. In addition, we have a growing body of large-scale statistical studies. For example, in 1975 and 76, the National Science Foundation conducted a nationwide garbage study looking at how garbage is collected in about 1,500 cities of all sizes all across the country. And they found that contracting out garbage collection to private enterprise was between 30 and 70% less costly than having it done by municipal monopoly. And this depended on which costs were included and what kind of figures you used. But it was overwhelmingly the case. And a similar study was done nationwide in Canada just last year that came to the same conclusion. A think tank in California called the Institute for Local Self-Government studied private for-profit fire protection in Arizona, comparing it with on a statistically valid basis with municipal fire protection in towns of comparable size and demographic characteristics. And they found that although the performance characteristics were equivalent, in other words, equally good response time and equally low rates of fires occurring and fire losses and so forth, that the cost per household was about 50% less in the communities with private for-profit fire protection. Most recently, a consulting firm in New York called EcoData looked at eight different public works services in Southern California. For each of the eight services, they took 10 Southern California cities that produced the service in-house, 10 cities that contracted with private enterprise on a competitive basis, and compared the quality and levels of service and the costs. They found that holding quality constant, the cost, it was 37% to 96% more costly to have government provide the service in-house than to have it produced by competitive contract. Now, this sort of track record has led a number of people to speculate about couldn't we achieve some of the same kind of benefits by privatizing a number of the activities of the federal government. And some people have pointed to Great Britain, where Margaret Thatcher's government has achieved a great deal of success in privatizing many formerly nationalized industries and enterprises in Britain. But other people will say, well, that's Britain, and they have all sorts of things to privatize there because they've had, over the years, a number of labor governments that have nationalized many enterprises. And we don't have nationalized enterprises in the United States. Well, here I think it's important to turn to the work of the Grace Commission. Many of you are familiar with J. Peter Grace, was appointed by President Reagan about 3 years ago to head up this huge task force of executives from all sorts of companies. They donated their time, documented in many volumes all sorts of instances of high costs and poor service in the federal government. And in fact, they showed that the federal government is heavily involved, much more heavily than most people understand, in commercial type activities. The federal government is the nation's largest landowner, owns about one-third of the land in the United States, the largest employer, employing nearly 5 million people. It's the largest insurer, the largest borrower, the largest lender, the largest tenant, and the largest landlord in the United States. In addition, it's involved in all sorts of other specific businesses of running data processing operations, producing and selling electric power, running airports, running air traffic control, delivering the mail, all sorts of things that could be done by private enterprise. Now, unfortunately, although the Grace Commission did document the fact that the government, in running all these enterprises, does a very poor job, they didn't recommend very much privatization. Most of what they suggested was that, well, simply, let's make these government enterprises run like a business. And people have been suggesting that for 30 and 40 years. The problem with that prescription is that it's utopian to expect that a government agency that is guaranteed funding by tax money, regardless of how it performs, that has workers given civil service protection, so they have essentially lifetime jobs, regardless of whether they work or whether they retire on the job. This kind of enterprise that has no competition by law, that's guaranteed the business, to expect it to operate in the efficient manner of a business that every day has to meet the test of, are we going to have any customers today or not, because they're free to go elsewhere if they don't like the price or don't like the service. That's absurd. You are simply not going to. There's no reason to expect that government enterprises will somehow be able to be pushed into operating like commercial businesses with the same kind of innovation and efficiency and responsiveness to customer needs. So the conclusion that a number of us are drawing from the Grace Commission is that what we really need, if we want to have some of these kinds of efficiencies, is to privatize many of these commercial activities run by the government, to move them in some way from the public sector to the private sector. I'd like to give you a few examples of exactly what that could mean. We prepared a list about a year and a half ago at the Reason Foundation just of a few examples of services that could be taken from the federal government and put into the private sector. And this includes a half a dozen, at least, communications and information businesses, such as census data products. The government is one of the largest information providers in the country, provides all sorts of information just drawn from the U.S. Census data to commercial companies at virtually no charge, and yet those companies then turn around and make all kinds of business opportunities out of it. Now, that's clear-cut commercial activity that's competing with other information providers, and so forth. Anyway, Postal Service, Weather Service, under the area of resources, the government is involved in huge amounts of producing and marketing electricity in competition with private enterprise. It owns commercial timberlands on a huge scale in the National Forest, a huge acreage of grasslands all through the West that it charges very below market prices for. In the transportation business, it's running a freight railroad, Conrail, passenger railroad, Amtrak, the two airports in Washington, D.C., the National Air Traffic Control System. It's providing virtually free services to people who own yachts. It's sort of talk about transfers from low-income people to higher-income people. The government is doing it in that area and many others. Even the military is doing a lot of commercial activities, such as cafeteria services and data processing services, hospitals, that could be purchased from the private sector, and for which there's a considerable case that money could be saved and it could be done more efficiently. All of these things that I've mentioned have been studied by private nonprofit think tanks, such as including my organization, but hardly limited to mine. There have been reports and studies showing why it would make sense and who would benefit from having these enterprises provided privately. Unfortunately, very little so far has happened. even though President Reagan, in his budget message in January, did talk about privatization and said it was going to be a major emphasis of his second term. Still, we've seen virtually nothing other than Conrail. There's been very slow and cumbersome attempts to try to sell that railroad. We need to look at why there hasn't been much actually happening, why it's been mostly talk and really no action. In sharp contrast to Britain, where there's been tens of billions of dollars worth of enterprises taken from government and put into the private sector. Let me focus on a couple of specific examples to illustrate what kind of benefits might be involved if we were able to move certain enterprises from the federal government and into the private for-profit sector. Let's take the example first of the U.S. Postal Service. Now, as most of you know, and as anyone who's in business knows, only certain aspects of postal service are government monopolies. Basically, ordinary first-class mail delivery is a protected government monopoly. Packages, the ordinary parcel post type packages, are delivered. There's a competitive situation there. United Parcel Service is the major provider. It actually has won almost two-thirds of the market away from the Postal Service. And overnight mail, premium delivery, is another thing that where private competition is allowed. That's only a relatively recent development. Only about the last 6 years have we had companies like Federal Express and Purolator and DHL Courier and several others allowed to compete with the government for priority service, fast overnight mail. And those companies, as you probably know, have done a terrific job. The Postal Service has attempted to compete with the Express Mail Service, but has a relatively small share of the market. Now, there's a very good reason why the Postal Service has a small share of that market, and it relates directly to the fact that it's a federal government enterprise. The key innovation that Frederick Smith, who started Federal Express, came up with to make overnight delivery work and make it a profitable business was having a central sorting hub. If you ever saw the program on 60 Minutes about Federal Express, you may know the story of how Smith did his MBA thesis at, I think it was Harvard Business School, on the idea of flying everything in at night to one hub in the middle part of the country, sorting it all out according to where it needed to go, and sending it back still at night in the wee hours of the morning so that it could be delivered by 10 o'clock the next morning. And, you know, this is a costly operation, involves investing in a lot of equipment and aircraft. But in fact, it's the key to making true next-day delivery work. He only got a C on the thesis, but he went on to attract venture capitalists and has made one of the most successful entrepreneurial businesses in the country out of Federal Express. Now, why can't the U.S. Postal Service do that for its overnight express mail service? In fact, it doesn't. In fact, the way the Postal Service tries to compete with that is by making deals with commercial airlines and buying space in the cargo holds of airliners. And, of course, since deregulation, airline schedules change practically daily. They certainly change every month. The official airline guide is always obsolete by the time it's printed, and that's why you can now get it on computer. And so they have a nightmarish time trying to match up the kind of air service that they need to get overnight letters and small packages from City A to City B without having their own central sorting hub and their own fleet of planes to do that. Why can't they do that? Talk to people in the Postal Service and on the Postal Board of Governors. It turns out that as a government enterprise, it's considered politically just impossible to get the authorization to spend the money to buy a fleet of planes and operate a central sorting hub. That would be competing with the private sector. With the airline industry would apparently go berserk and, you know, lobby and exert all kinds of pressure. And so it's just considered politically impossible to do that kind of thing in the public sector. And so here you have, in effect, the Postal Service unable, because of its nature as a government enterprise, to truly compete in the overnight mail delivery business. In addition, its attempts to compete in regular package delivery have been a fiasco. They've invested, I think, more than $1 billion in so-called automated equipment that's designed to sort packages. It's been a fiasco. Technically, it's been very poor, and they lose market share every year to UPS and the other carriers. Postal Service tried to get into electronic mail a couple of years ago. They even charging a price that only covered about one-tenth of its costs, they still lost a fortune, attracted very little business. There were simply too many constraints on, they had to use a certain number of postal workers to deliver this electronic mail, all sorts of things that just enabled them to not be an effective competitor. So the sad thing is, as more and more of what we count as mail, as postal products, gets converted to direct terminal-to-terminal electronic mail or to overnight priority delivery with the private firms like Federal Express, what's left for the U.S. Postal Service is going to be an increasingly shrinking portion. And in fact, we may see this whole government enterprise have no real future by 20 years from now. It may go down the tubes. So many of us are now starting to make the argument that privatizing the Postal Service, in other words, taking this whole government corporation, putting it into the marketplace, selling shares probably to the public, to the workforce, and so forth, is the best chance that it has of actually being able to survive. In other words, cutting loose of the civil service protection, the political constraints that say you can't buy your own fleet of planes, to save the Postal Service from an early demise, converting it into a true private, for-profit, competitive enterprise may be the best solution that we can have. And of course, doing that, putting it into the private sector, it would make sense to eliminate its monopoly on carrying ordinary letters and allowing anyone such as UPS or Federal Express to get into the business of providing regular daily mail service as well as the premium-priced overnight service and packages. Let's take another example. Air traffic control is an area that we're working in great detail on at the Reason Foundation these days. You remember that there was a national strike by the Controllers Union back in 1981 that practically shut down air traffic for a few weeks. And President Reagan fired the controllers and they hired new people and gradually have been rebuilding the system and trying to get it back up to capacity. Now, during this same time period, the economic regulation of airlines was phased out. We've had airline deregulation, so that we now have a much more competitive airline industry. We have fares that, in real terms, after allowing for inflation, are about 20% lower today than they would have been had old-style economic regulation continued. And as a result, many more people are flying than ever before. Greyhound is practically getting out altogether of the interstate bus business because airfares are so low that their market share has been really taken away by airlines, by low-cost airlines. And so this has created a huge increase in air traffic. Airports are jammed and so forth. And yet, at the same time, we have an air traffic control system that has been, its capacity is very seriously lacking. We don't have enough trained controllers because it takes a long time to build up the experience of rebuilding the workforce after the strike. The computers are obsolete. They fail frequently. Consequently, we have serious concerns about whether today's air traffic control system, run by a government agency, the Federal Aviation Administration, is actually providing an adequate level of safety. Every time there's a mid-air collision like the one we just had in California a few weeks ago, people get very concerned about it. It dramatizes the issue. In addition, there are huge and horrendous delay problems. I travel a great deal, speaking and doing other things, and the typical flight these days, particularly on the East Coast, encounters serious delays because there simply does not seem to be the right amount of capacity at busy airports at busy times to handle what we're doing. Now, why is that? Does it have anything to do with the nature of air traffic control being provided by a government agency? Well, in fact, there's a great deal of evidence that it does. One of the most basic functions, if this were provided by a business and the business enterprise saw that there's a demand that's greater than what we can supply, what would they do? They would spend money to increase their capacity, right? They would hire more people on a crash program basis, accelerate the training. They'd buy new computers with higher capability, get them into service as fast as possible. In other words, and they probably would have to raise their prices in the short term to generate the increased revenue to be able to gear up and meet the demand, okay? Now, why doesn't the government do that? Well, we have a sort of bizarre system due to the way it operates as a government enterprise. Unlike a private business, the air traffic control system doesn't charge prices for its service. Instead, what it does is charges taxes. They call them user taxes, but they're tax revenues. They charge a tax on fuel for private pilots. They charge a tax on airline tickets. What happens to the money from all that? Goes into a government trust fund for aviation uses. Well, that sounds okay. I mean, it's making the users pay for the service with a user-oriented tax. But what happens to that trust fund? Revenues coming in from those aviation taxes count as federal revenues over on the revenue side of the books. Spending out of the trust fund counts as federal spending and is controlled by Congress. Every year, Congress has to appropriate a certain amount of money from the aviation trust fund to go to spend on air traffic control and running the FAA. So what does Congress tend to do under pressure to balance the federal budget? They want to maximize the revenue side to get the government revenues up and hold down the spending side to make themselves look good as not contributing to making the deficit worse. So consequently, the Federal Aviation Administration, which runs air traffic control, is starved for money. They're about $1 billion behind on replacing the computers that are running the air traffic control system. Even though these computers fail, somewhere in the United States, air traffic control computers go down every day, and the controllers have to work with semi-manual backup methods. They're desperately short of people, but they can't hire enough of them because they simply don't have the money. Now, this is just totally backwards to the way a private business would work. What we are attempting to do is to show how to convert this whole enterprise into a private enterprise that would charge prices for the service so that those who use it pay directly. And in fact, not just charge the same price to everybody the way, or even more perversely, prices that don't bear any relationship to the cost of the service the way the FAA does, but to charge prices that reflect the market value of the services. Today, if you watch what happens at an airport like Chicago's O'Hare, the busiest airport in the country, a little single-engine plane flown by a private pilot can land at rush hour and pay a price that's based on the weight of the aircraft. You know, a light plane doesn't weigh very much. A 747 landing at rush hour at O'Hare pays a price based on the weight of the 747. Now, the amount of space, the amount of time and runway space and the slot for landing that it takes to land each of those planes is about the same. So that one single-engine plane carrying one person takes up the capacity that a 747 with 500 people would take up. And yet it pays this tiny fraction of the price based on the weight. And so consequently, you're wasting a huge amount of the capacity, the very limited capacity, at major airports at busy times. That kind of a pricing system is totally irrational, and yet that results from air traffic control and airports being run as political entities where lobbying by different interest groups, and believe me, the Private Pilots Organization is a very powerful interest group. It has members in every single congressional district, and it exerts a very strong pressure on Congress to control the way that the pricing is handled by airports and the air traffic control system. So consequently, we're wasting a huge amount of very valuable and very scarce resources by not charging the users what the true value of that service is. So the plan that we're coming up with, to make a too long story short, is to try to devise a private enterprise model that puts this on a corporate business-type basis, charging market prices, making users truly pay for the service, freeing it from all the constraints on civil service so that the private company could pay market prices, could pay incentive bonuses to get more controllers to where they're needed most. In fact, and as a private enterprise, could rehire the former PATCO controllers who struck and whom President Reagan refuses to rehire, even though they're the only large-scale source of trained personnel that could quickly rebuild capacity. All those elements are included in the plan that we'll be proposing probably by the end of this month. And which is already being written about by several newspapers. One final quick example of the price that we pay, and this is, I'll use another aviation example because this is one of my special interests and I used to work in aerospace, and this concerns government weather forecasts. Now, many people will say, well, obviously this is a government function, and who would do it if the government wouldn't? But in fact, most weather data is not purchased by ordinary citizens like you and me. Most weather data is purchased by large commercial organizations, including television stations, newspapers, and transportation companies, which desperately want and need up-to-date accurate weather information. to use in their operations. Now, unfortunately, the government isn't motivated to do a really good job because typically it's not paid directly by its users for the weather data that it provides. It's paid for by tax money that we all pay, and then the information is basically given away at no charge to all these commercial users. Just one little piece of the weather data situation will show you the kind of things that we're missing out on. Airlines today depend crucially on forecasts of what the winds are going to be up at high altitudes where they fly. You know, you can have 50, 100 mile an hour headwinds, tailwinds. That makes a big difference in how fast the flight goes and how much fuel they have to burn. Truly accurate, up-to-date forecasts could allow them to plan which altitudes to fly at much better. And in fact, according to NASA meteorologists, the airlines, if they had probably hourly information about the winds at different altitudes, could save about $1 billion a year in fuel costs. Now, what do they get from the government's weather service? They get forecasts twice a day, every 12 hours, from weather balloons that the government sends up at various locations around the country. Would the airlines pay to get better data so they could save that $1 billion a year in fuel? You bet they would. We've talked to chief meteorologists at United Airlines. They would gladly pay. But because the enterprise is set up as a government entity with the money, with the budget coming from tax money, and even if the Weather Service put on a user fee, that money wouldn't go to the Weather Service. It would go into the government's general fund, and Congress would use it to help balance the budget. There is no way in the existing structure for the users who would willingly pay more to get better information to be able to do that, to make that real. So yet another reason, another example, the kind of benefits we could get by putting these ventures, these commercial enterprises, into the private sector and out of the government with all the constraints on it. Well, can we actually do that? Is it realistic to talk about, or is this just a pipe dream that sounds nice on paper? Here, I think what's really crucial is to look at the experience of Great Britain under Margaret Thatcher's government, because they have developed techniques for making privatization of large-scale government enterprises a politically feasible thing to do. First of all, what they've done is looked at who would benefit from privatization in each specific case and focused on identifying who those beneficiaries are and communicating to them how they would benefit so that they're motivated to get together and be for privatization. The focus of the explanation needs to be on the benefits and not simply on cutting the budget, which makes it look like, you know, some kind of accountant with a green eye shade trying to slash things away. Then once you understand and focus on who the beneficiaries are, it's very important that thorough, detailed studies be done. And this is kind of this is my special interest pleading, because that's the kind of business that we're in as a think tank. But the homework needs to be done. A member of Congress is not going to accept simply good rhetoric saying that private enterprise is good and government fails. The details need to be worked out specifically to show exactly what are the features of a particular government enterprise that make it ill-suited to doing a commercial task well, and exactly how would the transition be made and how would the private enterprise operate once it were done, and how do you package it in such a way that people would actually support it. And this gets to the third key element, and that is to build a coalition of people who would benefit from privatization. And this involves lobbying work. It involves all sorts of efforts to get user groups and providers of service and allies within the government who favor competition, private enterprise, such as the Office of Management and Budget and the Council of Economic Advisors, to put this all together into a team who can actually state the case and bring the votes together for it. And the final key element, and this is where the British have really excelled, is to essentially figure out how to buy off the opponents. And I'll give you one example of this. British Telecom is the name now of the British Telephone Company. That ever since telephones were invented in Britain, telephone service had been provided by the British Post Office. And it wasn't the case of an industry being nationalized. It had always been a government function, unlike the United States, where it's always been private enterprise. Well, when Margaret Thatcher decided to privatize British Telecom, the public employee unions, who were one of the strongest government unions, were vehemently opposed, and they told all the workers, this is a terrible thing, this is against your class interest as a worker, this is destroying and, you know, giving away the national heritage and so forth, and you must oppose this. Well, Thatcher's government said, we want these guys on our side, so what did they do? They decided to give every worker in British Telecom a few shares of stock in the new company when it went private, and allow them all to purchase an additional block of stock at a huge discount from the market price. So the union said to the guys, don't buy this, oppose it, it's terrible. Government said, here's a free gift. We want you to like this idea and take it. Guess what the workers did? 95% of them bought the stock. And they purposely structured the public offering so that no single company could buy more than a small fraction of the shares. The idea was to get millions of individual citizens to purchase stock, and they did a great advertising campaign and publicized it. And as a result, over a million individual private citizens did buy stock in British Telecom the day it was offered. And that one act doubled the number of people in Great Britain who own stock. I mean, Britain has never been much of a stock-owning country. It's been mostly wealthy people that own stock. But overnight, the number of people who own shares in private industry was doubled by the act of privatizing British Telecom. They also deliberately priced the shares lower than they thought would probably be the market price, so that within the first few months, the share price practically doubled, and everyone felt better off. The workers who had been given stock and bought at a discount, the individual citizens for whom this was the first time they'd ever bought shares, were delighted to have their stock rise in price. And when the government goes back to sell the remaining 49% in a year or so, they're going to make a great deal more on the second round of the sale. They're going to have enough money that they're going to be able to cut the rate of income tax by 1 or 2 points and make everyone even happier. And so you see, what they've done is very cleverly thought out how to neutralize opposition and make it in the interests of large numbers of people to have this privatization take place. In marked contrast, you look at the Reagan administration's bumbling efforts to sell Conrail to a big company, and you have to wonder what kind of political savvy is really residing there in Washington. It's really kind of appalling. But we do know from watching the British do this time after time, they've developed something like 22 different techniques for making privatization politically feasible, for giving people a real stake in seeing enterprises move from the public sector to the private sector. So to sum up my basic message, I think, is that today we have a golden opportunity to restructure our federal government in this country, to reduce its size and scope and cost by recognizing how many different commercial activities and enterprises the government is trying to do and do badly. If we can manage to figure out how to privatize successfully a large number of these activities in the way that the British have done, not only will we reduce the budget deficit by shrinking the size of government, we'll also produce uncounted benefits for all sorts of people in the United States in the ways that I've attempted to illustrate. And that's why I really do think that privatization, far from being, as some people have called it, a national garage sale, really is a golden opportunity to have a better goods and services for all of us. Thank you very much.
Today, University Forum has presented Robert Poole, president of the Reason Foundation of Santa Barbara, California. His topic was privatization, national garage sale, or golden opportunity. The question-answer period of the program was not recorded due to time considerations. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private, undergraduate liberal arts college located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.